Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on House of Bush, House of Saud, right after this message. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. But if you can't afford Spence, then my second choice would be you. That's right, you are the best guy, the best person to represent your interests in court. After all, you were there, and you either did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said, and you know who said it. You know who was lying. You know who is telling the truth. You know. But your lawyer doesn't know any more than you can tell him, and besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. The abhorrence of the profession of lawyers is documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history. Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher in King Henry VI exclaimed, "The first thing we do is kill all the lawyers." Dickens wrote, "If there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers." Poor Richard, in his almanac, said that God works wonders now and then. Behold, a lawyer, an honest man. Well, so scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish, always slippery. Both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial assemblies. Brigham Young, when he established his utopia in the Utah desert, characterized the lawyers as a stink in the nostrils of every Latter-day Saint. And he described the courtroom as a cage of unclean birds, a den and a kitchen of the devil. Early in the 19th century, the Baptist preacher John Leyland attacked a host of lawyers who infest our land like the swarms of locusts in Egypt and eat up every green thing. Now, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and three rules. That is, don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about House of Bush, House of Saud, the incestuous relationship that we have between the Bush family in the United States, President George W. They call him W back there in Washington, down in Texas. W. Bush and his daddy, George Herbert Walker Bush, and the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. There are close personal and business ties between these two dynasties, these two clans, and it has very far-reaching political and international geostrategic implications for you, for me, and for everybody else that lives in the world. They're sitting on 25% of the world's oil, and America is the world's number one industrial power. We have to have the oil, and if the Saudis said, "We're not going to sell you any more oil, we're going to sell it to the Japanese," we would go to war in the morning. I mean, in the morning, if it lasted that long, to secure that 25% of the world's oil. Well, by the spring of 1990, Saddam Hussein's love affair with the White House had now survived 10 years of the Reagan-Bush era. And thanks to Saddam's overreaching, Richard Pearl was about to get his wish. Now, Pearl, remember, is that Jew in the Defense Department. I'm not sure that he's still there. He was with the National Defense Council, as I recall, and there was some flap over his double-dipping or something. Well, anyway, as a rule, in the Arab world, it didn't hurt to lash out at Israel. But on April the 2nd, Saddam made the kind of slip of the tongue of which diplomatic catastrophes are born. He boasted that he had chemical weapons and would use them to make fire eat up half of Israel. James Baker's State Department immediately issued a statement saying that the remarks were inflammatory, irresponsible, and outrageous. Saddam was so stunned by the angry reaction from Washington that he promptly got on the phone to King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and demanded that Fahd send someone to Iraq immediately to act as a go-between with the United States. And the best man for the job was Fahd's nephew, Prince Bandar. Now, it was the kind of task at which Bandar excelled. By now, he was a specialist in back-channel operations. Bandar had so assiduously cultivated the powers that be in Washington that he lived in a realm far above any other mere diplomat. Bandar was chosen and was close to James Baker, the National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell. Between 1984 and 87, Bandar met or talked to Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger at least 64 times, by count. Colin Powell noted with distress that the Saudi billionaire functioned as if he were a cabinet officer within the Bush administration. Even that was an understatement. Bandar was free from the congressional oversight that constrained those very same cabinet officers. And his relationship with President Bush was what truly set Bandar apart. During Reagan's first term, Bandar had lunched with Vice President Bush several times and had lunched with him many times. In 1985, when Bush was just beginning to be derided as a wimp by the media, Bandar staged a huge party for Bush, with entertainment, by singer Roberta Flack, and Bandar said that he regarded the president almost like a buddy. The relationship went both ways. From the administration's point of view, Prince Bandar was important because he was both a confidant of King Fahd's and had close contact with Saddam Hussein, as reported by Bob Woodward in The Commanders. On April the 5th, just after Saddam's remarks about Israel, Bandar flew to Iraq in his own private jet. When Bandar sat down with Saddam, the Iraqi dictator insisted that he had been misinterpreted. "And I want to assure President Bush and His Majesty King Fahd that I will not attack Israel," he said. 4 days later, Bandar met with Bush in the Oval Office, and he relayed news of the conversation. George Bush Sr. was stunned. If Saddam didn't mean to attack Israel, then why had he said it? Even though Bush was skeptical about trusting Saddam, he resumed his generous policies toward Iraq. The Commerce Department tried to stop the flow of U.S. technology to Iraq, but its efforts were stymied by the White House. In May of 1990, the Bush administration continued to share military intelligence with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In July, the White House pushed for additional agricultural loans to Iraq and rebuffed efforts by the Defense and Commerce Departments to restrict the export of dual-use technology. And at the end of July of 1990, Bush opposed congressional efforts to impose sanctions on Iraq, all in an effort to bring Iraq into the family of nations. George Bush and Saddam had kissed and made up. Well, or so it seemed. Meanwhile, the State Department joined Defense and Commerce in becoming increasingly concerned about Saddam Hussein's Iraq. On July 19th, The State Department sent a memo to Baker advising stricter controls because Saddam was developing chemical and biological weapons and was working on nuclear weapons. Iraq has been attempting to obtain items to support these proliferation activities from U.S. exporters, and in some cases successfully, said the memo, which was initialed by Baker to acknowledge that he had read it. Now, according to the memo, a review had uncovered 73 export licenses for goods that were sent to Iraq that were probably proliferated or proliferation related. In addition, it included 17 licenses for bacteria that could be used with biological weapons and computers for chemical and weapons programs. Finally, Baker changed course. On July the 25th, he asked the Commerce Secretary, Robert Mosbacher, for new controls over exports. Iraq's extraordinarily aggressive weapons proliferation efforts make this situation urgent, wrote Baker. That same day, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, was summoned to a rare meeting with Saddam Hussein. For years, Iraq had nursed a grudge with Kuwait concerning the oil-rich border shared by the two countries. Earlier that month, Iraq had accused Kuwait of stealing Iraqi oil and engaging in an imperialist Zionist plan to depress oil prices through overproduction. According to the government-controlled newspaper in Baghdad, Kuwait had seized Iraqi territory and stolen $2.4 billion worth of oil from disputed oil fields along their border. Well, on July the 27th, 1990, Bander told the administration that Saddam had assured Arab leaders that he was not going to invade Kuwait. But Saddam had been lying. By then, he had already sent 30,000 troops to the Kuwaiti border. And by July 31st, the number had risen to 100,000. On August 1st, a CIA assessment reported that Baghdad almost certainly believes that it is justified in taking military action to reclaim its stolen territory and oil rights. So the very next day, Iraqi troops invaded Kuwait, and by the middle of August, the total number of Iraqi troops in Kuwait and the nearby region was more than 200,000 Iraqi troops. Worse, the Iraqis were within striking distance of Saudi Arabia. And according to Dick Cheney, another 40,000 Iraqi soldiers had been deployed in southern Iraq near the Saudi Arabian border. Now, this was George Bush's worst nightmare. To defend the biggest oil fields in the world, he had helped build Saddam into a powerful military force as a bulwark against the Islamic fundamentalist threat. But now Saddam himself had become the threat. Iraq already had enormous oil reserves. If he won the Saudi oil fields as well, with the oil from Iraq, Kuwait, and the Saudis, Saddam would control 40% of the world's known oil reserves. Well, to President Bush, also an oil man, such a prospect was horrifying. Saddam would be able to manipulate oil prices at will and would have the American economy at his mercy. The Reagan and Bush administrations had created a monster. And now the Bush team dramatically switched course. On August the 5th, President Bush stepped off Marine One on the White House lawn and, referring to the Iraqi invasion, uttered the most famous words of his presidency. He said, "This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait." The spontaneous remark meant one thing, and that was war. But before that could happen, the United States had to build an international coalition. It had to make sure that the Saudis would allow the use of American troops on Saudi soil, and it had to build domestic support as the United States began to deploy forces in the Middle East. James Baker brought the Soviets on board, worked the United Nations Security Council, and lined up $15 billion each in promises from Saudis and Kuwait. And that was just the beginning. On November the 3rd, 1990, Baker left Washington and visited 12 countries on three continents over the next 3 weeks. And according to his memoir, the day after Thanksgiving, I had set a personal record with a 37-hour day that took me from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to Bogota, Colombia, to Los Angeles, and then to Houston. I met personally with all of my Security Council counterparts in an intricate process of cajoling, extracting, threatening, and occasionally buying votes. A coalition was coming together. But Saudi cooperation was still an open question. As close as George Bush Sr. was to the Saudis, he could not be certain what course of action they might take. In fact, Bush and Prince Bandar had wildly different views about Kuwait. Bush's relationship with Kuwait went back 30 years when he was head of Zapata Offshore. He had built Kuwait's first offshore oil well with the approval of the ruling El Sabah family of Kuwait. The Kuwaitis were his benefactors, and he was forever indebted to them. By contrast, Prince Bandar had only contempt for Kuwait, which he derided at every opportunity, even stooping to bathroom humor. When Bandar excused himself to go to the men's room, he would be known to say, "I've got to go to Kuwait." In addition, the royal family was divided. On the one hand, the House of Saud was outraged by Saddam Hussein. Saddam doesn't realize that the implications of his actions are upsetting the world order, Fahd told Bush. He is following Hitler in creating world problems. I believe nothing will work with Saddam but the use of force. And on the other hand, the House of Saud would face fierce opposition from puritanical Islamic clerics if American infidels use the Holy Lands to attack Iraq. So as a result, it was essential that the House of Saud see that Saddam was an imminent threat to their survival. So on August the 3rd, Cheney called Bandar to his office for a meeting with Colin Powell, Under Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, and the National Security Council staffer Richard Haass. Now the purpose was to convince Bandar that Saddam intended to attack the House of Saud as well. Cheney and Powell took out overhead photos that showed three Iraqi divisions moving through Kuwait, one of them directly toward the Saudi border. The other divisions might follow, and Riyadh is just 275 miles away. When Cheney arrived in Saudi Arabia a few weeks later and asked permission for American troops to use Saudi bases, King Fahd had clearly gotten the message. The Saudis didn't just want Saddam ejected from Kuwait, they wanted him destroyed. Now, Secretary of State James Baker reported that the Saudis wanted to eliminate Saddam Hussein. And for them, the only solution was an American-led war that would annihilate Saddam's military machine once and for all. Having convinced the House of Saud, the Bush administration still had to win the hearts and minds of Americans. So in the United States, one of the most effective lobbyists was Prince Bandar. Again, and again, Bandar persuaded even the most unlikely allies in the United States thanks to an approach that was extraordinarily ecumenical for one of the preeminent custodians of an Islamic theocracy that rivaled the West. At a memorable private breakfast in late October of 1990, one could enjoy the spectacle of the most prominent Arab in America wooing over the capital's staunchest supporters of Israel, including Representatives Stephen J. Solores of New York and Tom Lantos of California, Robert Torricelli of New Jersey. Bandar even sent out Christmas cards to influential Washingtonians with a very non-Muslim message. It said, "Behold, the angel said, O Mary, God giveth thee glad tidings of a word from him. His name will be Christ Jesus, the Son of Mary, held in honor in this world and the hereafter, and of the company of those nearest God." That's the caption on Prince Bandar's Christmas cards for 1990. Now, winning over the public at large, however, required more convincing. The problem was no matter how evil Saddam may have been, Americans seemed to find him more palatable than Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini, who referred to the United States as the Great Satan. Now, true as villains go, Saddam was straight out of central casting. He had killed hundreds of thousands of Iranians, thousands of his own Iraqi citizens. He had used chemical weapons and committed atrocity after atrocity. But because Saddam had long been an ally of the Reagan and Bush administrations, such heinous crimes had gotten little attention in the media, and few Americans thought of him as a dangerous enemy. Well, given that Saddam's atrocities against Iran and the Kurds had not stirred the American people, then why should his invasion of Kuwait cause more than a ripple? Very few Americans even knew where the tiny emirate of Kuwait was located. And even if they did, why would Americans want to go to war over this particular border dispute? If this was about defending democracy, Kuwait certainly didn't make the cut. Only 65,000 people out of a population of 2 million were given the privilege of voting. Males who could prove Kuwaiti ancestry dating back to 1920 were at the top of the list. Women had no political rights whatsoever. Executive power was in the hands of the emir, who was chosen by and was a member of the ruling al-Sabah family. Senator Daniel Patrick Monahan had described Kuwait as a poisonous enemy of the United States, famous for its singularly nasty anti-Semitism. And since most Americans thought oil was not good enough, or a good enough reason to go to war, both Bush and Baker floundered for a rationale as to why America should put soldiers in harm's way. If you're trying to get me to say that low gasoline prices are worth American lives, it's not something I'm going to say, said Baker. The fight isn't about oil, Bush asserted. The fight is about naked aggression that will not stand. All of which meant that Americans suddenly had to buy into the notion of Saddam's villainy, even though it was a villainy that their government had secretly supported for many years. And to that end, the Kuwaiti government swiftly poured millions of dollars into 20 public relations agencies, lobbying groups, and law firms to rally U.S. public opinion against Saddam Hussein. On August the 11th, just 9 days after the invasion, Hill and Knowlton agreed to represent Citizens for a Free Kuwait. That was a front group funded almost entirely by the Kuwaiti government. The vast majority of the budget of Citizens for a Free Kuwait went to Hill and Knowlton. Hill and Knowlton was not just the world's biggest public relations firm, it was also the most politically wired firm in the United States. The firm's chairman, Robert Gray, had been a key aide to both Ronald Reagan's presidential campaigns. And on the Democratic side, the firm relied on Vice Chairman Frank Mankiewicz, who had worked for both Robert F. Kennedy and George McGovern. In this case, however, the most important politico on the Hill and Knowlton staff was the man running its Washington office, Craig Fuller. Fuller, a friend of President George Herbert Walker Bush, who had served as his chief of staff when Bush was vice president. Now, with Fuller on the Kuwaiti account from day one, Hill and Knowlton went into overdrive. They put 119 executives in 12 offices across the country onto this project. And according to Second Front, John R. MacArthur's account of U.S. censorship and propaganda during the Gulf War, Hill and Knowlton organized a Kuwait Information Day on 20 college campuses on September the 12th. Then, on Sunday, September the 23rd, churches across the United States observed a national day of prayer for the embattled Kuwaiti emirate. The next day, Americans celebrated Free Kuwait Day. There were tens of thousands of bumper stickers and t-shirts, as well as media bits and media kits on Kuwaiti history. Hill and Knowlton's Lou Allison, a former news producer for CBS and NBC, created 24 video news spots about Kuwait for the evening news. All over the country, there were full-scale press conferences showing torture by the Iraqis. And as the end of 1990 approached, the American media, which had largely ignored Saddam's atrocities against Iran and the Kurds when they took place, again and again, broadcast reports of Saddam's mayhem in Kuwait. On October the 10th, Hill and Knowlton was granted a forum to present its evidence against Iraq before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Their chief witness was a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl who was said to have first-hand knowledge of Iraqi atrocities. She went only by her first name, Nariah. Her last name was withheld, presumably in the interests of preventing reprisals against her or her family. As recounted in Second Front, Nariah cried as she testified about her time as a volunteer at the Al-Aldem Hospital, where I was there. I saw the Iraqi soldier come into the hospital with guns and go into the room where 15 babies were in incubators, she said. And they took the babies out of the incubators and took the incubators and left the babies on the cold floor to die. Unquote. Well, after the hearing, Congressman Tom Lantos said that we have never had the degree of ghoulish and nightmarish horror stories coming from totally credible witnesses that we have at this time. Unquote. And President Bush said that he was happy that the atrocities in Kuwait had been highlighted on CNN. And Bush referred to the incubator story at least five more times during the next 5 weeks. Amnesty International published the story with only a minor qualification, saying that over 300 premature babies had been left to die, not 15, 300. And it repeated again and again, and it spread quickly all around the world. As MacArthur pointed out, it's difficult to overstate the significance of the incubator story. Saddam had done many horrible things, but Nariah's testimony suddenly enabled the press to compare him to Hitler. Here you had a guileless teenage girl's tearful account of a dictator so depraved that he would have his soldiers kill innocent babies. And even though he had long supported Saddam, President Bush himself fueled the Hitler analogy, asserting that Saddam's troops had performed outrageous acts of barbarism. I don't believe that Adolf Hitler ever participated in anything of that nature, said Bush. Well, over the next 3 months, the baby killer story made its way along the media food chain. It was referred to again and again in speeches by President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle. It was in the New York Times and the Sunday Times of London, on CBS and CNN. It was in Time magazine and on the wires, and in countless newspapers across the country, from the Los Angeles Times to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But it wasn't true. While the story was in the news, Middle East Watch, a New York-based human rights organization, was also following up on the story. But unlike most of the American press, it did not simply repeat previously published reports without verifying them. So they sent an investigator named Aziz Abu Hamad to hospitals in Kuwait, where he found many doctors who refuted the incubator story. And in January of 1991, a memo, less than 2 weeks before the war began, Hamad noted that I have yet to come across the name of one family whose premature baby was allegedly thrown out of an incubator. And he added that while he could not irrevocably refute the charges about the incubator story, he had found many bogus stories about the Iraqi atrocities in Kuwait. And many prominent Kuwaitis had been reported dead before I left for Saudi Arabia, but I was surprised to find them all alive and well. Well, that's a part of propaganda. Now stand by, we've got to take a break here. We'll be back with more on Craig Unger's House of Bush, House of Saud, right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when talking to the police or government agents, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law, and that is, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make these kinds of short, terse statements like this. Listen to this first judge. He said, quote, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? That came from U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Listen to the second judge. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That comes from Belknap versus United States. If I said that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now listen to what the third judge said. He said, quote, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and farsighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can just go to the website georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, on October the 11th, 19 Saudi Arabian citizens hijacked four airplanes and crashed them into targets here in the United States. And all of those 9/11 participants were Saudis, not Palestinians or Jordanians or Iraqis. So what's the connection between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia and George W., George Bush? Well, on March the 15th, 1991, after the Gulf War was over, ABC News John Martin finally sorted out the mess. In his news report, he quoted Dr. Mohammed Matar, the director of Kuwait's primary health care system, and his wife, Dr. Fareza Youssef, chief of obstetrics. No, the Iraqis didn't take the babies away from their incubators. And to tell the truth, no nurses to take care of these babies, and that's why they died. Martin again specifically asked if Iraqi soldiers had left the babies on the floors to die. And they said, quote, I think this is something just for propaganda, unquote, replied Matar. Even Amnesty International, the highly respected human rights organization that had helped publicize the story, now issued a retraction, asserting that its team had found no reliable evidence that Iraqi forces had caused the death of babies by removing them or ordering their removal from their incubators. How had such a false but provocative story become part of the conventional wisdom that created the war-frenzied support for the first Gulf War? For that, we have to go back to the original source of the story. Remember the teenage girl, Nayara, the 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl who had testified before Congress? After all, what better source for reporters across the country than congressional testimony? Even though it was not under oath, from a tearful teenage girl, and even though she declined to give her full name. Now, just who was this Nayara? At the time of her testimony, her full name had been kept secret to protect her family from reprisals in occupied Kuwait. But as John MacArthur revealed a year after the war was over, there was a better reason for keeping her name secret. You see, Nayara was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, Saad Nasser al-Sabah. And such a pertinent fact might have led to impertinent demands for proof of Nayara's whereabouts in August and September of 1990, when she said that she witnessed these atrocities as well as corroboration of her charges. And it's worth adding that Nayara was not just the ambassador's daughter, but as such was a member of the ruling family of Kuwait, the same family that had granted oil concessions to George Herbert Walker Bush's Zapata Oil offshore company 30 years earlier. Now, at the same time that Nayara was telling Americans about Iraqi atrocities, the Pentagon began telling Americans about the looming Iraqi military threat. By mid-September, even before Nayara's testimony, the Bush administration claimed 250,000 Iraqi troops were in Kuwait and the surrounding region. But there was compelling evidence that the Iraqi military threat to the Saudis had either been vastly overstated by the United States or that Iraq had withdrawn its troops. In August, a Japanese newspaper approached Peter Zimmerman, a fellow with the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, with photos of Kuwait taken by a Soviet commercial satellite company. Zimmerman showed the photos to various other experts, and all of us agreed that we couldn't see anything in the way of military activity. The media, however, was too cautious to run with a story saying that the Pentagon had exaggerated the Iraqi military threat. Nevertheless, ABC News pursued the story and bought a set of 5 Soviet satellite pictures of eastern Kuwait and southern Iraq, which were taken on September the 13th, at a time during which the United States asserted that the Iraqi military force was at full strength. According to Zimmerman, the photos were astounding in their quality, but when he reviewed these photos with another expert, both of them were shocked, not by what they saw, but it was what they didn't see. We turned to each other and we both said, "There's nothing there." Nothing suggested an Iraqi military presence anywhere in Kuwait. In fact, Newsweek reported, all they could see in crystal clear detail was the U.S. buildup in Saudi Arabia. Where were the Iraqi soldiers? Well, the evidence strongly suggested that Cheney's presentation to Prince Bandar 6 weeks earlier was vastly overstated, or that the Iraqis had retreated, one or the other. Now, ABC News, however, had neglected to obtain photos showing one 30-kilometer strip of land in Kuwait. Perhaps all of the Iraqi troops were hiding in that one sector. But an enterprising reporter in Florida named Jean Heller got her newspaper, the St. Petersburg Times, to purchase the missing photo, and it too showed no sign of missing Iraqi troops. So the Pentagon kept saying the bad guys were there, but we didn't see anything to indicate an Iraqi force in Kuwait or even 20% the size that the administration had claimed. So as the story spread, the Pentagon's public relation machine shifted into damage control mode. A spokesman said the military sticks by its numbers, then went to work discouraging ABC, CBS, and the Chicago Tribune from pursuing the story any further. ABC News' Mark Brender explained that the network dropped it partly because the photos were inconclusive, but also because there was a sense that you would be bucking the trend. If you're going to stick your neck out and say that the number of Iraqi forces may not be as high as the administration is claiming, then you better be able to say how many there are. One of the few major newspapers to suggest that Iraq never really showed up for battle en masse was Newsday, which, after the Gulf War was underway, reported that American troops had encountered a phantom enemy. It noted that most of the huge Iraqi army, which was said to have 500,000 troops in Kuwait, and southern Iraq simply was nowhere to be seen. In addition, as if foreshadowing the Iraq War of 2003, Saddam Hussein's supposed chemical warfare never materialized. And one senior American commander told a Newsday reporter that the information about the Iraqi defenses put out before the war was highly exaggerated. There was a great disinformation campaign surrounding this war, the first Gulf War, he said. Later, after America's overwhelming military superiority quickly defeated Iraq, only one serious criticism of George Herbert Walker Bush's triumphant policy emerged, and that came from within his own administration. Why on earth had we not allowed, or had he not allowed, American troops to march all the way to Baghdad and overthrow Saddam Hussein and get rid of him? Well, in A World Transformed, a book that he and his national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft, published in 1998, Bush explained that he allowed Saddam to stay in power because trying to eliminate Saddam would have incurred incalculable human and political costs. Apprehending him was probably impossible. We would have been forced to occupy Baghdad and, in effect, rule Iraq. There was no viable exit strategy that we could see, violating another of our principles. And furthermore, we had been self-consciously trying to set a pattern for handling aggression in the post-Cold War period, going in and occupying Iraq, thus unilaterally exceeding the United Nations mandate. Would have destroyed the precedent of international response to aggression that we hope to establish. Had we gone the invasion route, the United States would or could conceivably still be an occupying power to this day in a bitterly hostile land. Now, that response was persuasive, but it did not satisfy everyone, particularly Paul Wolfowitz, the rising young policymaker in the neoconservative camp, who was then Under Secretary of Defense. In 1992, just after the Gulf War, but while George Bush was still in office, Wolfowitz oversaw the drafting of a policy statement on America's mission in the post-Cold War era. It was called Defense Planning Guidance, the 46-page classified document, which was co-authored by L. Lewis Libby, who later became Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff. Circulated at high levels in the Pentagon, and after it was leaked to the press and met a hostile reaction, the White House ordered Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney to rewrite the highly controversial document. The policy paper was never implemented during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, and soon Bill Clinton was in the White House. Nevertheless, a decade later, Wolfowitz's original draft became extraordinarily relevant. It outlined several scenarios in which U.S. interests might be threatened, focusing specifically on North Korea and Iraq, where the greatest dangers were and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism and a sudden shock to the global supply of oil. The policy paper also asserted somewhat patronizingly that coalitions of the type that Bush and Baker had put together for the Gulf War hold considerable promise, but that in the end they were not necessarily the answer. The United States, Wolfowitz insisted, would have to be prepared to take unilateral military action, and Wolfowitz's policy suggested a new sort of militaristic idealism in which preemptive strikes were justifiable if they took out a brutal dictator. And if such actions alienated America's longtime allies, he seemed to be saying, so be it. That was the price that we must be prepared to pay. As to whether the new policy might commit the United States to enormous costs, both in terms of human life and in dollars, or whether it might lead to even greater dangers, Wolfowitz had no answer. Now, for all of their anti-Americanism, even the most militant Islamists agreed that something had to be done about Saddam Hussein. Hussein was a secular ruler who was seen as bent on destroying Islam. Immediately after Iraq invaded Kuwait in August, one of the leaders went to Riyadh to meet with Defense Minister Prince Sultan and to present him with an alternative way of going after Saddam Hussein in Iraq without having to rely on the U.S. military. The military leader, that militant leader, who went to Riyadh to talk about how to get rid of Saddam Hussein without American help, that militant leader was Osama bin Laden. Now, by this time, a battle-hardened 33-year-old bin Laden told Sultan that the kingdom did not have to allow American infidels on Saudi soil to fight Saddam's troops. Fresh from driving the Soviets out of Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden was ready to take on another superpower, the United States of America. And armed with maps and a detailed 10-page plan, bin Laden asserted that his family's construction and engineering equipment could be used to quickly build fortifications. And thanks in part to U.S. support for the Afghanistan campaign, bin Laden already had a global network of Islamic warriors ready to bolster Iraqi forces. And if the Islamic forces could defeat a true superpower like the Soviet Union, he argued, they could certainly take on Saddam Hussein. As Muslims, Iraqi soldiers could not possibly be deeply committed to someone as secular as Saddam and would not resist the jihad. Stunned by bin Laden's proposal, Prince Sultan warned Osama that Saddam Hussein had 4,000 tanks and there were no caves in Kuwait, he said. You cannot fight them from the mountains and caves. That what will you do when he lobs these missiles at you with chemical and biological weapons? Bin Laden said, we will fight him with faith. And bin Laden said that he could lead the fight himself and promised to put together 100,000 former warriors from Afghanistan, still devoted to the House of Saud. And bin Laden warned the royals that if they followed U.S. soldiers or allowed the U.S. military near the holy mosques of Medina and Mecca, militant Islamists, not just in Saudi Arabia, but throughout the entire Muslim world, would not overlook Riyadh's transgressions of the sacred principles of Islam. In its search for military security, he said, the royal family risked losing its religious legitimacy. And according to one report, for reasons that are still unclear, Osama bin Laden left this meeting with Prince Sultan, thinking that the House of Saud agreed with him and was going to accept his offer. But soon he received the news that would transform his life and the world's geopolitical future. King Fahd was going to allow U.S. forces into Saudi Arabia. Now, to bin Laden, this development was a backbreaking calamity. For decades, the secretive House of Saud had maintained its two different royalties in reality. And in the West, it proudly paraded its alliance with the United States as evidence of its security and the Saudi entry into the modern world. But within Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud had downplayed any ties to the United States so as not to provoke militant Islamists. Now, however, the double marriage between the two mortal enemies was out in the open. When King Fahd asked the senior Islamic clerics who oversaw the Saudi judiciary to endorse the idea of allowing U.S. troops into Saudi Arabia, they refused. Allowing American soldiers on sacred Saudi soil was so abhorrent that it called into question the very legitimacy of the House of Saud as the custodian of Islam. And throughout all of Saudi Arabia, Islamists could talk of nothing else but the schism between the royal family and the clerics. Now, in the presidential race of 2000, George W. Bush, called W for short, had the advantage of instant name recognition across the entire width and breadth of America. His birthright included a spectacular Republican fundraising apparatus, and as heir to an extraordinary brain trust, he had the ultimate Washington insiders and oil industry executives on his side. His father was a former president, James Baker, one of the most powerful non-elected officials in American history, Donald Rumsfeld, a former Secretary of Defense, Condoleezza Rice, who had served on the Elder Bush's National Security Council, and was a director of Chevron. Dick Cheney, the former Secretary of Defense, who had become CEO of Halliburton, the giant oil services company. But for all of its advantages, the Bush political legacy was also a mixed blessing because it carried the liability of being a nationally known political brand that had failed. And among the senior Bush's chief contributions to the American political lexicon was a solemn declaration that had come to be synonymous with broken political promises. Read my lips, no new taxes. Who else had been derided on the cover of national magazines as being a wimp? It was George Herbert Walker, Bush's W's father. To make George W. Bush's task more complicated, the 2000 campaign was taking place at the end of a prosperous 8-year Democratic reign. The Monica Lewinsky sex scandal, as embarrassing and damaging as it was for Clinton, had played out during a mood of national economic euphoria. It was an era of dot-com millionaires, bulging 401ks, frenzied online day traders, and SUVs driven by soccer moms. 22 million new jobs had been created during the Clinton years, and unemployment had fallen to its lowest levels in decades. The Dow Jones average was flirting with 12,000, and the NASDAQ had broken 5,000. It was a period of unparalleled peace and prosperity. America seemingly ruled the world as never before, and with Vice President Al Gore and the uncontested Democratic nominee, the challenge for the GOP was clear. Bush had to make the case, as one Republican media consultant joked, that because things had never been better, it was time for a change. Well, the task of reinventing and marketing this flawed brand fell to Karl Rove, Bush's longtime friend, confidant, and handler, who had earned the Bush Brain Trust. His solution was to create a Rorschach test candidate so that moderates, conservatives, and independents would see in Bush exactly what they wanted to see. Bush's theme of compassionate conservatism meant whatever someone wanted it to mean. To Wall Street Republicans who couldn't care less about social issues, crucial to the anti-abortion, anti-gay, pro-gun Christian right, Bush was his father's son, a genial and appealing moderate who would be good for business. To the powerful cadres of the radical Christian right, Bush's vow to restore honor and integrity to the White House, his promise that his deepest commitment was to his faith and his family, meant that he was unmistakably one of them, one of the Christian right. But few voters realized, for example, how dissimilar the Texas governor was from his father. Not content merely to bring back the ancient regime or the Bush-Reagan era, George W. wooed key conservative constituencies that the elder Bush had failed to bring into his camp. One was the powerful Christian right. Given his difficulties winning the trust of born-again evangelicals during the 1988 presidential campaign, the elder Bush had given his son the task of working with the campaign's liaison to the Christian right, an Assembly of God evangelist named Doug Weed. When evangelists asked Vice President George W. trick questions designed to reveal whether he was really one of the flock, he almost always stumbled. But his son was a natural, and according to Weed, if asked what argument George W. would give to gain entry to heaven, he would say, "I know we're all sinners, but I've accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior." That was the right answer. Bush had become so attuned to all of the nuances of the evangelical subcultures that virtually no one questioned his sincerity or his acceptance of Christ. But even if you did, as author John Didion has noted, it didn't matter. The larger point was that Bush had replaced his father's visionless pragmatism with the certitudes of good and evil. Where the elder Bush was, as one colleague put it, utterly devoid of conviction on almost any subject, his son was forging a neo-Reaganite vision that jibed with an evangelical sense of destiny. W's bond with the Christian right was a crucial part of what distinguished W from his father. And as Bush contemplated his candidacy, he repeatedly met with evangelical leaders. And in October of 1999, he addressed the powerful but secretive Council for National Policy, a body that had attracted the who's who of the evangelical movement. The organization's founding president was Dr. Tim LaHaye, author of the best-selling Left Behind series of novels that sold millions, prophetic, military, religious thrillers that extol the rapture, the moment when true believers in Christ will be raptured off into heaven. Now, at the time, the Christian right had focused largely on domestic issues concerning values and morality, abortion, homosexuality, gun control, prayer in the schools, and so on. But LaHaye and his millions of followers, the 11 books in his series have sold 55 million copies, added a new foreign policy dimension to its agenda, and specifically with regard to the Middle East. According to LaHaye, the armies of the Antichrist would soon have their final battle with Christ and witness the end of history after a series of conflicts in the Middle East, not unlike those taking place today. And this belief that the events in the Middle East were part of God's plan, that Christ would return only after Israel truly controlled the Holy Land, put the Christian right on course for a low-profile liaison with a highly unlikely political ally. Hardline, pro-Israeli, neoconservative, defense policy intellectuals. The neocons, who had also bedeviled his father, were the other constituency with whom Bush quietly mended his fences. In the late 80s and early 90s, one may recall defense policymaker Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, who had close ties to the Israeli right, had criticized George Bush Sr. first for his pro-Saddam policies and later for not ousting Saddam after the Gulf War. Well, in 1992, the notorious defense planning guidance paper written by Wolfowitz argued for military action in the Middle East as part of a larger plan to rid the world of rogue states. But the Bush White House had rejected it as too militaristic. Well, we're just about out of time, boys and girls. I got to leave it there. We'll conclude this next time. House of Bush, House of Sod, written by Craig Unger. Be sure you get one. $26 U.S., $39 Canadian. Published by Scribner & Company, copyright 2004. You can order a copy from Barnes & Noble or any bookstore. ISBN number 0-7432-5337X. Remember, that's Scribner & Company, copyright 2004. House of Bush, House of Sod, written by Craig Unger. I rated about a 1 in 100 read. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried on worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There's the signal, says time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, with the conclusion of House of Bush, House of Sod. So until then, good night, friends.